welcome to the second part of Robbie the Robot's Waiting, SFX Magazine Special, where we're looking back on 25 years of a sci-fi and fantasy institution. I'm Tanavi Patel, and I'm joined by all five of SFX's editors from its long history: Matt Bielby, Dave Golder, Dave Bradley, Richard Edwards, and Darren Scott. If you haven't listened to the first part yet, go back and do that. If you have, we'll pick up the story of the world's number one sci-fi and fantasy magazine.
I think you sort of credit shows like Buffy, The X-Files, Doctor Who as being sort of milestones for the magazine. But I was wondering what kind of key milestones you've gone through during your 10 years in the magazine.
Issue 8 or something like that, we did the first SFX Readers Awards. And we got everybody to vote for their favourite things in all sorts of categories. And we got a great response to it, and it really gave us a good feeling for where the audience was and what they liked and didn't like. X-Files walked it, you know, just swept the board on the first one. And that was sort of massively useful, I think, that we sort of realised that people liked Babylon 5 a lot as well. Mm. I don't think we quite realised how big a following that had.
Do you remember Mary Branscombe, one of our early freelancers? She was going on about Babylon 5 from about day one. And then finally we had to admit, yeah, you're right, Mary.
I know. I hated admitting that.
Yeah. Yeah, same here. Yeah. Like, yeah, you're right. It's gonna be
But it was also a big event we could do in awards, and did you do awards every issue for every year from then on? I can't quite remember, but
during my year, right?
Yeah,
sure. We did a number of awards. We often did it just in the pages of the magazine, although we were lucky that we were able to do it live a few times. We hosted the SFX awards at the SFX Weekender for the 3 years that we ran that, and I think possibly even live
before
Yeah, I was gonna say before that.
So I did it live in Blackpool.
Yeah, that's right.
It's actually somewhere in the archives of SFX, there's a photo of me looking absolutely exhausted after I came off stage. And it's one of my favourite photos of me ever, because I look thin. That was a great night. That was really, really amazing. And I can't quite... It was the most unreal moment of my life, in the fact that I actually felt like a superstar with like all these thousands of people in that audience, sort of like all clapping me, and then like going, but I don't deserve any of this. You're actually clapping everybody else. Yeah, they were great. I really enjoyed those award nights. They were cool.
Do you remember some of the awards that you gave out?
Oh, I remember a couple actually that we did. We had a category in the awards, which was always the biggest disappointment that we invited people to vote for. And what I remember, though, is that in a lovely twist to this, the readers all voted that their biggest disappointment was that Stan Lee hadn't appeared in a cameo of a Marvel film. Rich, you might remember which one it was.
I think it was X-Men First Class.
That's right, yeah. So we had an acceptance speech from Stan Lee, who sent us a video of him being disappointed that he was everyone's disappointment, which was kind of a lovely twist on that. So I remember that. Also, I remember we did a... We gave a Legend Award to Brian Aldiss. He's no longer with us, the author. And what I recall about that is, I think Rich and I have the same recollection, which is we said that we wanted to give him this award and bring him in person to this award ceremony. And he asked if we would helicopter him there, to which we kind of went, no, that's really expensive. It's really expensive. So he didn't get a helicopter to the event, but he did come to the event and was treated like a rock star, which for a retired, you know, an aging writer was kind of lovely. It was lovely that, you know, there amongst all the kind of fans of Buffy and The Walking Dead and the other TV shows were on at the time, they were given a standing applause to, you know, standing ovation to Brian Aldiss. I kind of quite cherish that memory. That's quite a kind of thing to be able to do.
You had SFX events, you had the awards, you had the Weekenders, you've had conventions, book cons. So you've actually, for guys who are writing and often behind your computer screens, you've had lots of opportunities to meet your fans. So can you tell us about some fan encounters?
It wasn't an encounter for me, but it was like watching fans in action at a convention, and I always remember this. It was the same Blackpool convention I was on about earlier. Who played Anya in Buffy?
Emma Caulfield.
Emma Caulfield, right. We're all in the green room. It was Emma Caulfield, not just me, Emma Caulfield and James Masters. There was a number of other people, but us three were all in the green room. And it was one of those weird conventions where the green room and the toilet, the stars had to like go through the main hall to get to the toilets. And so they couldn't like just nip to a toilet. And Emma Caulfield was like, oh my God, I want to go out there. I want to go out there and I can't. There's all these fans. And I just remember James Masters like going, leave it to me. and he just like left the green room all the straight to him, and then Emma Caulfield sort of sneaked out behind him, went to the loo, and then got back, and he was still looking the whole time. And as soon as he got back, he kind of went, "Bye, fans!"
Like a honey pot
to the green room. Yeah, exactly. It was. I always remember that. That was a brilliant moment.
Well, Darren, I guess you mostly must meet the fans or engage with the fans over social media. So, what's that like for the most part?
It's great fun, actually. A lot of people just send me messages like I know them. me personally, not to the SFX account, but and it's fine because, you know, I get they're excited about things I'm excited about, so I I just think that's really great. I think it's great to have that something so positive to come from it, because especially in a world where social media can be quite grim and everyone can be at each other's throats, it's really nice that people could just actually reach out and have a conversation with somebody about something that they really love. And I would love to do, I mean, when I hear about the SFX events that have been before, I would love to do that. And I was hoping to do stuff through this year. Obviously,
really?
That didn't happen.
that damn pandemic.
I know. But hopefully one day we'll get to do some kind of SFX event again, because I just think it would be, I mean, everything I hear about the ones before have just been so great. I just think that it would be, really great fun to do, I think.
Even the smaller book ones were amazing. You know, where we just went up to London to Foyles and did stuff there. That was great. It was like, you know, it's just fun. It's just fun meeting people. Yeah. It's fun meeting readers. It's good.
We've talked about the fans of the magazine, but there are some special contributors in terms of staff, I think, without whom the magazine wouldn't be the same.
I guess the first ones were David Langford, weren't they?
And, Langford.
John Grant, who had their columns. Yeah. I can't quite remember how they came to the Mag. Maybe you can remember, Dave, but I thought possibly John Grant got in touch and then sold me the idea of the two of them as a sort of double header, as a little package.
That's my memory of it as well, yeah.
Yeah, Langford was like a, you know, quite a hard guy to talk to on the phone particularly. So it was useful to have John as a sort of intermediary kind of guy. Those guys gave us some sort of weight and sort of British science fiction sort of fandom kind of history to the magazine from the off, which you wouldn't have had before. And we sort of attacked it from two angles, where we had these fairly heavyweight guys that were winning kind of, you know, Hugo Awards and stuff fairly regularly, doing columns for us. At the same time, we were going big on TV shows like The X-Files, which were taking science fiction in a much more mainstream direction than had been happening up to that point. And so it felt really cool that we could come at it from both sides, basically, and guys like that gave us the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, it definitely gave us some weight, definitely. I was like, yeah, I like that. Then when I took over, I had Paul Cornell as a columnist for a while.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, I really, really wish he hadn't become so busy and successful, because his columns were brilliant. I really, really...
Didn't you have Simon Pegg for one issue?
Maybe two. Maybe two? Maybe one? I can't remember. In my head, maybe we got to two.
And where is he now?
Mates with Tom Cruise is where he is now.
Yeah, that was my problem. I kept like choosing people who got far too successful.
there are other, you know, regular contributors. Obviously, I think on the magazine itself, you know, Nick Setchfield, Ian Berryman, and Steve O'Brien, who was there, I think, for a lot of our time and left while we were there. All absolutely fantastic writers, and
if well, I Mike to... Simpson at the beginning as well.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Amazing,
writer, yeah, absolutely. And you know, if I tried to list all the contributors, I'm sure many of them still write for the magazine. We'd be here all night, because the magazine that does lean on a lot of external writers over the years. I don't know whether the readers realize how much of the kind of the staff and the freelancers the mix is there. I think when you read a magazine and you're not familiar with how the media works, you maybe think that everyone works in the magazine and that you're in an office with like 200 people in it or something. But actually, of course, the mag depends on a lot of external.
And I've got to mention, sorry, this is favoritism, but I've got to mention my friend Jane.
Jane Nelson.
Jane came at a time when a lot of, you know, like a lot of women started getting into science fiction because of things like Buffy and the X-Files as well. And it was great. She captured the kind of moment. I'm really glad that you know, employed her, because she caught a kind of a vibe and she knew exactly, and it was exactly right for the magazine at that time. James, a very important part of the whole mix.
One of the most satisfying things actually working on the mag is when you find a great writer, you know, someone who writes the first time, they've made the pitch, and you're like, okay, we'll give you a go. And actually, it turns out that they've really got it. They really get the magazine, and then they end up writing loads for you. It's really cool when that happens.
We should probably say that we've been quite lucky with our kind of American correspondents, and I know that I think Tara still writes for the magazine, Darren. She's your kind of US editor, and
people I work with who are like this, like Tara, and all of you guys are all contributing various things as well. It's just pretty. I've been so lucky because I've inherited 25 years of brilliant people.
I mean, it is truly a global magazine, but at the same time, I think people, listeners, might be surprised to hear that it's based in Bath, and there's not that many of you in the office at any one time, and there seems to be a whole cohort of sci-fi writers there. And so in terms of, you know, being there and not potentially being in a bigger city or, you know, LA or somewhere, does that have its pros and cons?
At risk of sounding partridge, it's equidistant between Cardiff and London, which is perfect if you cover Doctor Who.
It certainly made a difference in the early days, doing things like having people in London take you seriously, let alone LA, because they thought you were some sort of weird yokels from the West Country. And you lived on trains a lot of the time, up and down, because you know, the internet wasn't what it is now, and you had to physically collect things from London quite a lot, and you had to go and see films there for screenings, and you'd often have to then run across town to get the last train home to, you know, try and get back to Bath,
or miss it sometimes.
I should say, I think Darren actually is based in London these days, though. Am I right, Darren? You're actually in the capital.
I've got one foot in London, one foot in Bath, and the world in between.
Well, I mean, that seems to be something that's changed. And obviously there's been a lot of streamlining of the magazine industry as a whole, and SFX has been included in that. So I was just wondering, you know, in terms of for each of you and challenges that you've had to face during your editorship, can you talk little or big things? Can you talk
about the biggest challenge that we had when I was doing it? Was entirely my fault, entirely self-inflicted. And that is, I came up with what I thought was a genius idea of having spinning page numbers on every page of the magazine.
There was a little atom with
a page number inside it on every page, and the ball on the atom went round by one stage every page. So it was almost like if it had been a flick book, it would have worked as a little animation. But it wasn't a flick book. It was right in the center, bottom of the page. You couldn't flick them or anything. And yet we had to get it right every issue. And every time you change the flat plan or change the page number, you had to not only remember to change the number, but you had to remember how the ball goes, whether it was one thing round the previous page or not. And it made every page an absolute horror. And I don't know why anyone allowed me to do that and why people didn't mutiny against me for this stupid idea.
Magazines and the 90s were a very different place.
And I guess at some point, some very wise person, probably Dave, binned that off as a concept.
Do you know what? It was me, but I didn't want to. I still think it's a great idea.
I can tell you one challenge that happened when I was editing, and it was the same when it's the same time that Richard was there, and it's something that I think that SFX now does very well, and that Darren's team are kind of attuned to this, which is that during the period that I was working on SFX, that was the revolution online where social media started. When I joined the magazine, there was no YouTube. That wasn't a thing. There was no Facebook. There was no Twitter. There was no Instagram. That actually all happened about 2 years after I started the magazine, and we had to deal with that and kind of how we'd communicate with our readers differently. And it changed things like, it took a long time, but it changed things like Spoiler Zone, because when I joined the magazine, we were still reviewing TV that we were accessing from America that people couldn't see in the UK. And within sort of 2 or 3 years, streaming services started. So there was a bit of a kind of an online revolution that involved, on the first issue I worked on, there was kind of no way even to see big trailer releases online. There was, you know, like I said, there was no YouTube or anything. by the time I left, you know, we were competing with YouTube influencers and Instagrammers and stuff. And I don't think I ever really kind of got my head around that, you know, entirely in a way that I think subsequent editors have. And I see Darren's team posting on the Games Radar where SFX lives and in your Instagram channels and stuff. And I think that's great. But that was definitely a challenge for us to kind of get our head around different ways of communicating. Do you remember that time, Rich? You must have been the same.
Yeah, I think as well, that thing about, you know, when people are watching TV, you know, you had some people who are watching in the US, some people who are watching in the UK on Sky, some people who are watching on terrestrial. So what was a spoiler would vary depending on what rate you were going. We did introduce that spoiler threat thing, didn't we, with traffic lights so you could work out.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Red meant it was only aired in America. Amber was on satellite and green was, you know, this is safe for everybody. But yeah, I mean, that was a weird mind fault. Yeah, I think that the way that the internet changed was a big thing to get used to. I mean, when you think that the forum, the SFX forum, was such a big deal, you know, that was the communication mechanism that we kind of controlled. Twitter and Facebook still allow people to communicate, but you don't have that kind of, well, control's not perhaps the right word, but it's not your space in the same way. Mm-hmm. I think the challenges for most of my time on the mag were very similar to what everyone else has faced. I mean, anyone who's run a magazine will know that getting cover art is a pain. Getting access is hard work, you know, making sure you're getting the interviews, and you're competing with loads of other magazines. And I think as it's gone on, you've been competing with the internet more and more, and the sort of almost balance of power has shifted. You know, so sort of back in the noughties, you know, magazines still sat sort of high up, and they were the sort of respected medium, and the internet was this kind of young pretender. But that really has shifted. And, you know, you'll get a lot of publicists now who aren't necessarily thinking about print in the same way. And they're perhaps not doing as many of the cool cover shoots. In fact, movies have got much less good at that. I think TV is still doing them really well. I think if you look at the Red Dwarf covers that Darren did earlier this year, UK TV supplied some really good shots for you. And it's not the same for every show or movie. Sometimes you have to work with, you know, what you get.
Yeah, tell me about it. Not a challenge for us, for SFX, I think, because we are so used to it now. I think it's just like you were saying earlier on about people assuming that there's a cast of thousands, and in fact there's only three of us full-time working on the magazine. The rest of it is outsourced to a very extended SFX family from over the years, I have to say. So I mean, Nick Setchfield is still editor-at-large. Jonathan Coates, thank God, is still designing because he manages to make something incredible every month without you having to actually ask him to do it. He just takes what he's got and makes something incredible. And Ian is you know, is the fountain of knowledge for everything. So we do all work quite hard at it. Like people were saying earlier on about it, sometimes you do work at night and everything as well because you care about it. So that's not a challenge. It's just I think people think magazines are one thing, probably because they've seen them on telly or whatever, and actually the reality of it's quite different. But with something like SFX, it works because of the network that we've built up over the year, that you guys built up for us over the years. So thanks for that, because you're making my job much easier.
you just reminded me of something, Darren. You said there about what people, the perception of magazine editing, when they see it on TV, they think we live like the Devil Wears Prada, right? But you've reminded me of that, which isn't even one of my anecdotes. Rich, I'm just feeding you a line here, because didn't you get a chance to explain to somebody how magazines are edited?
Of course, Anthony Head, formerly of Buffy, was playing an editor, a magazine editor in a TV show on ITV, I think, and obviously the magazine he thought of to do his research was SFX. So he came into the office in Bath. I mean, he lives fairly locally, sort of came up to the floor where we worked, and it was brilliant. You know, he was asking really good questions. So why do you do this? You know, you've got the flat plan, which has got every page in the magazine laid out on it. And so you can see how it all fits together. He's like, oh, what's this? Can I take it with me? Yes, Anthony Head, you can take SFX's flat plan with you. That's fine. It was just a really surreal experience.
And if you wouldn't mind subbing a few pages while you're there.
Well, exactly. Yeah, we did put him to work. Yeah. It was just a surreal experience, because you could just look around the office and just see people looking up and think, he looks familiar. It's that guy from the Gold Blend ads.
Having been able to kind of immerse yourself in that world, then have you still got people on your bucket list that you really want to meet, really want to interview, or things that like shows that you really want to visit?
I wanted to interview Grot Bags, but she died.
Oh. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. What was this?
She had trademarked, or she'd applied for a trademark on the Bazzazza. Now, if you don't know, if you know Pink Windmill, Emu's Pink Windmill.
Yeah.
She applied to trademark the Bazzazza and the Hovergrot. I don't know why she didn't create them, but so but yeah, I just tackled. I found it that way, and I found Croc working in a theatre in London. He's not actually a croc; he's a real person. So I got close, but she just wasn't biting. She is a fantasy icon, I would argue.
You should make when you get a chance to think about it, you should make it a little list, because you're the one of us who's still in the position to chase these people down. You've got a calling card, so you know while you're there. Cross your items off the list.
Well, you can give your requests to me and I'll do them for you.
Yeah.
They've
been vicarious too.
Well, I would have said Diana Rigg, but I think that ship has sailed, hasn't it?
Yeah. R.I.P.
Can't think of too many others. I was very pleased to have got to interview Olivia de Havilland. Not very science fiction, but, you know, a little bit before her death. That was felt sort of special.
I think it's better thinking about the people I have interviewed. If I kind of look back on what I have done, you know, the people who I have met and had the chance to speak to, that's way more important than the people I haven't had the chance to, you know. And actually, sometimes if you sit down and go, God, I've done that, and that, you amaze yourself a little bit. You know, and as Darren said earlier, it's something that you never take for granted, because, you know, you always appreciate, I think, what a lucky position you're in to do it. And actually, you know, you can start the day and I'll be doing the school run and it'll just be like, you know, just normal. And then the end of the day, you're sort of sitting in a nice hotel in London, sort of sitting opposite an amazing Hollywood star talking about a movie. Kind of surreal, but brilliant.
Any starstruck moments?
Kind of have your starstruck moment afterwards, I think. You kind of have to.
There are people that you meet and just they look so bizarre when they are actually there in the flesh in front of you. I remember thinking that about Angelina Jolie, that she just looked so sort of Angelina Jolie-esque, you know, which is not sort of like a human. That was sort of quite weird. And you didn't know quite how to talk to her. It was like you were talking to an alien. Most people don't scare me, but that sort of did, because she was so sort of surreal looking for some reason, like hyper real.
I think it's the small talky bit that's the hard thing, though. When you're getting into questions, that's fine, because, okay, I'm doing a job now, I know what I need to find out, and there's that fear of getting back to the office and having nothing to write if you haven't asked any questions, and that's not good. And because interviews are a kind of odd transaction, really, because for that 15, 20 minutes, you've got the full attention of the person you're speaking to. You know, it is their job to talk to you. But then when it's over, you're back to being strangers. So it's not the kind of encounter that you kind of have in many other sort of parts of life, you know, where you're sort of best friends for that 15 minutes and then it's just turned off at the end.
I do remember, like, and this is really weird because it's being starstruck by somebody who wasn't a star at the time. I interviewed Tom Hardy when he was basically Jean-Luc Picard. And nobody knew who he was. And I went to interview him at some trendy place in London, which I'm sure people who like trendy places in London would be very impressed by, and I can't even remember the name of. He was amazing. I was sitting there like going, you were terrible in this film. I really hated the film. And I'm interviewing you. And I basically want to go and have sex with you in a cupboard. And I was absolutely bowled over by this guy. I thought, my God, you are amazing. And then, like, Tom Hardy becomes, you know, everybody knows who Tom Hardy is now. And you just go, yeah, that's the charisma I was feeling. You know, like, he was amazing. I mean, he is terrible in Nemesis. There's no two ways about it. And so, therefore, I'm going to do this interview. You were awful. I'm going to hate you. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, my God, I think I love you. I actually spent the next 6 months or whatever, like, going, new Doctor Who. I want him to be the new Doctor Who. He's going to be brilliant. He would be the best Doctor Who ever.
I think that's the biggest compliment you can give, Dave. To ask someone, to want someone to be Doctor, to play the Doctor. Yeah.
You also got to meet Red Fraggle, Dave.
Red Fraggle. It's still on YouTube. I checked it the other day. I check it like once every week. It's still there. Like, me interviewing Red Faragle, which is the best moment of my life. It was that was amazing.
So, looking forward, guys, obviously, I'm hoping that SFX is around for another 25 years. But given the amount of changes, especially for you this year, Darren, what do you envisage with the magazine and how it might change going forward?
I know what I want, which is I want to, part of the whole reason that I came on board and wanted to do, apart from it obviously being this amazing dream job that you never think you're going to get, but it was because I was really passionate about putting it under people's noses again. Mm-hmm. And making people see that it is a nerdy, geeky magazine, but in the best possible way. It's just a brilliant magazine. That's what I want. That was my intention, was just to get it under more noses and to make people see that it's an incredible magazine. And also it's a fantastic heritage brand, I think, that Future owns. And I really want Future to fully embrace that. And I want to sort of run with that, really, to be honest. And that's what I was saying earlier on about the idea of having conventions and events, mm-hmm. and just doing more and more than we possibly can. And, you know, just whatever we can do to sort of spread that joy, I think, but also just to keep the brand going and to keep the magazine alive. The thing is, I think there will always be sci-fi magazines, and I genuinely think, whether or not I'm involved with it in years to come, that it should be SFX, because I think it's earned its place. It's mm-hmm. it's done something that no other sci-fi magazine's ever done, and I think that needs to continue. I think the readers need to have that, the writers need to have that, and the people that make all these shows and films and write the books, they need to have it too. I think it has that perfect mix of everything. I mean, that magazine could be twice the size every month.
Mm-hmm.
It would kill John. but it could be. You know, I just... I mean, and I will do everything I possibly can to ensure that SFX has a very long life.
I think people have been really quick to write off magazines. You know, they say, oh, yeah, the internet does this and this. But as Dave Bradley has said, you know, many times over the years, you know, TV didn't kill the radio. Magazines have never been the source of up-to-date news. They've always been sort of competing against TV and radio and stuff. But magazines can do something that the internet doesn't, and that's curating. You know, the internet is this big mass of information. When a new trailer comes out, say the new Star Wars film, everyone will be writing very similar analysis features saying, you know, this is what this means, this is what that means. You know, people aren't necessarily sort of probing the sort of weird areas of the genre. Now, in SFX, if you want to sneak in a retro feature about Hawk the Slayer, you can do it. You know, you're not worried about how many people are going to read it, because you know you've put the big sort of Star Trek thing on the cover. You can do a box out that might just appeal to a few people, but enhances the feature. And that's what magazines do brilliantly. Pictures work better in magazines than they ever do on a computer screen. You know, you can go big on them. They look fantastic.
Super magazines, high res right there.
Yeah, magazines are brilliant. And I don't think they're sort of going anywhere yet. The relationship with it will change. Perhaps younger readers need sort of more educating in why magazines are brilliant. But there's a lot of people out there who love getting stuff on paper.
So I agree. I'm so fed up with like going on the internet and everything is like in portrait. And I love the fact that in magazines, things are landscape. And I love that. So let's get people over this kind of everything has to be in portrait kind of idea. No, magazines are landscape.
I think one of the great things about SFX magazine is the fact that you cover such a variety of stuff. And like you say, it's for the fans. So there's intricate detail about things. And certainly as a reader, for me, I learned about lots of shows and even sort of subgenres that I wouldn't have known about before. But I was wondering, I mean, despite you covering just so many things from toys to books to the big movie features, is there any kind of aspects that you would want to, if you'd had the chance again, maybe sort of done differently or added in, or a particular sort of feature that you had to cut that or had to change that you would have wanted to keep?
I wouldn't have given the first episode of Demons 5 stars.
Did that happen? You are joking, aren't you?
I get reminded of this on a regular basis.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Oh my God, okay. Right, okay. No, I thought you were joking then. Okay. No, that's fair enough. Like, we all have weird moments. I mean, you know, I have many weird moments, so I'm not gonna judge you on that. And I genuinely, being serious, I look back on my era, and my era was that kind of hinterland between boys' magazines and the more aware we are now. And I cringe at some of the things I did. I genuinely cringe. I look back at it and think, oh my God, you know, like the Sexiest Star stuff, and you know, the Xena Warrior Princess is just awful. I've got a lot of regrets. But I can only sort of say in my defence that I was throwing a lot of stuff at the wall and seeing what stuck. It was just, I don't know. It was a kind of weird period, and people quickly took me up on it, and I think I reacted well. But there's some stuff now that, like, a lot of the people who are on the internet who do hashtags a lot will be hashtagging my era a bit. I do apologize. I'm not going to excuse it. I'm not going to say it was a thing of its time. I'd like to think I learned a lot that way.
Well, so speaking of that, because obviously you guys had an amazing job in just being there at SFX, but what were the take-home sort of messages or the take-home lessons that you learned whilst you were there?
Bright pink covers really work. Bright pink and bright orange.
Which one of you guys put a dinosaur on the cover? I want to say it was a Triceratops.
Ray Harrison, yeah. Yeah, it was a Ray Harrison Triceratops. That was issue 5, I think. I think that was a really bad selling issue. I think if one issue was going to kill SFX stone dead, it would have been that one. But we'd done X-Files just beforehand, so that showed us the future. And Triceratopses, sadly, were not the future.
that was one of fan base that you failed to mobilize.
It really was. But I didn't sexualize it anyway. You know, stop Dave from doing that.
Yeah, he's got the horn.
Oh, Lord. Yes, you should have written the cover line.
Actually, can we talk about sex for a minute? Because
yes,
I'm now stuck with the people telling me that I'm doing this on purpose by covering up the F.
Oh wow!
That old.
Oh my God! It's taken this long before somebody mentions it.
I think we should probably go to Matt Bilby first on this.
So I remember naming the magazine, and the obvious things to call it were very boring things like, I don't know, Science Fiction and Fantasy Monthly or something. We weren't going to do that. And I wanted a very short name, and I wanted the letters S and F in it. So then I was trying to think of something that was very short that would have the letters S and F for science fiction in it. And SFX was the best one I came up with, and it sort of meant special effects. I suppose it also meant sound effects, but which isn't as relevant. And so I thought that was cool. It looked amazing when we put it on the cover. And at some juncture around here, I am sure we all became very aware that it looked like sex. And if you covered up the bottom of it, it looked like sex. However, that was a good thing, right? This was the Dave Golder sexualization era.
It was the 90s, man. It was the 90s.
Yeah, you know, Loaded was out and stuff like that. You know, it was. But also, the first few issues, we made sure we didn't cover up the bottom of it, and we kept it. It was like the Vogue logo back in the day used to always be just plonked right over somebody's face, and they would never cover up the logo. But more recently, they have covered up the logo and stuff. But back in the day, that was one of their rules, I believe. And for SFX, for about five issues, we didn't cover up the logo at all. And then, certainly towards the end of my run, we started covering up the logo quite a bit. But I think I'm right in saying I was always sort of aware not to cover up the bottom of the F if we could help it. But sooner or later, I knew that inevitably we would cover it up.
You never told me that.
Have any of you ever tried to intentionally cover the bottom of the F so it looked like, you know, so it was ambiguous? Or has it always been an accident?
No.
It was always an accident.
Yeah. Likewise.
It was always just the art editor would go, it looks better this way. Designer, sorry, nowadays, would go, so it's better this way. And, you know, okay. Fair enough.
I had one time where I was asked not to make the cover star cover up the F. So it's like, it mustn't look like it says sex. The weird thing about this, and I'm not going to say what movie it was, but the cover star wasn't human at all.
Ooh, it was that Triceratops again, wasn't it?
Yeah. It had a grudge ever since.
I might bring it back. For the anniversary. Ask him where he's been. I'm very careful now because I think I didn't really know the first issue that I did, and I had the Stranger Things cast on the cover and didn't even consider that it would say, it would look like it might say sex behind them. So, yeah, ever since then, I've been very, very careful to make sure that the F isn't covered if at all possible.
My justification for the name was always that it stood for something and that it stood for science fiction explosion.
Oh, really? I thought what you were going to say. Science fiction extra is what I've heard. I'm sure that
no,
I've heard
it was
that
explosion. It was explosion. Wow. Because my idea was that science fiction is exploding. This is like the year.
Right.
1995, that science fiction is going to really bust through and become mega mainstream. And it maybe took two more years.
Well, one of the things that people always want to know when you have such a panel of experts as you guys are in your field is advice for should someone want to follow in your footsteps and become editors of SFX magazine, what should they do?
Be patient, because it doesn't come up very often. I mean, there's only been five of us in 25 years, so it's... People hang around.
Be patient. I think also, you know, embrace everything that SFX can stand, or everything that science fiction and fantasy can be, really. Just don't be narrow-minded. Just be open to everything. It's got many great strengths. But one of them is just that so much different material goes through that magazine, and so many things. I think various people have touched upon this today. You get a new appreciation of something you didn't think you'd like through SFX all the time. And every single issue I see, I go, actually, I didn't think I'd be interested in that, but I am interested in that. And that's great. And do that and pick up on that and keep open-minded and don't judge anything too quickly. Probably that was what I'd say.
Yeah. And also, I think just don't completely set your heart on writing for a sort of science fiction magazine, because there aren't that many out there. You know, get some experience writing in all sorts of different places, you know, become a good journalist, become a good editor, because if you can take those skills and put them into something that you really love, that's brilliant. You kind of have to get the grounding first, because the chances of you walking into your dream job straight off are quite slim.
My advice to anybody that wants to be editor of SFX is don't even think about it.
Oh man, it's like the mirror universe in Star Trek, right? Someone's gonna have to come up you with a knife in the back, and that's the only way they're gonna get you off the
I used to work in gay publishing. my advice would be to keep writing. I mean, I started off writing for fanzines, and that's what got me into my place at university, and so, you know, keep going. Just take every opportunity that you can to work towards what it is you want to do. Because I think certainly when I was at uni, people just thought, oh, we don't have to do this now until we've actually graduated. The first chance I got to write for local publications and all of that, I just took it and I ran with it. I loved it. It was the best. So, and that ultimately will lead you to where you want to be, I guess. I mean, I'm here now, so worked for me.
I would say learn how to express how you love something rather than how you hate it. Because internet snark is taking over the social media. I think people are more interested in what you like about something rather than what you don't like about something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
That's so true.
And I think if you want to get a career in magazine writing, maybe the editor of SFX is obviously the goal, but also just to be maybe a freelance contributor or something, what I would say is don't be afraid to celebrate the things you love. And to extend what everyone's been saying here, just dive into that geekiness. The fact is actually that what magazines and what media generally and what the world needs is experts in things. And you're probably an expert in something. If you love it passionately and you celebrate it and you're a big fan of something, you probably know more about it than, you know, enough to kind of communicate that. So I think don't be afraid. I'm always a little bit, you know, sad when someone maybe applies for a job at the, you know, when I was on SFX or the company I work now, and they send their CV in and they try to be as, you know, to say the things they think we want to hear about, you know, how much they love Star Wars or something, and then buried away right at the bottom is this particular kind of fandom of anime or something that they really love. And I say you should shine a spotlight on that, because that's the place where you can maybe have a chance to shine and show your expertise.
Mm.
Yeah,
if you can do something no one else can, that is the best way to open the door.
Well, on that note, this is something that I'm curious about, but I've left it for the end in case it's more of a competition than discussion. But who is the biggest sci-fi nerd out of you guys?
I think Golda watches the most TV.
I don't know Darren well enough, but I think I'm possibly the TV nerd. Definitely films other people can definitely trounce me, but yeah, I like my TV, science fiction and fantasy. Yeah,
but the thing is, sci-fi fandom is such a broad church, so I think all of us would probably have areas where we're kind of geekier than the others.
Right, we're like the perfect trivia team. Right, we've got someone who can do books, someone who could do TV, and someone who could do between us. We cover everything.
I think it's actually an interesting question, though, because what makes you geeky? Is it actually loving it, or is it knowing it intrinsically that you know the minutiae of it? I don't know.
I think it's a blend of both.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think you could know everything about everything or something and not really care about it. You can know facts about things and not really care about them. But I think it's both.
I think there's a lot of similarities between football fandom and sci-fi fandom. A lot of football fans would hate me saying that, but if you think about it, you know, like dressing up, like following something intently, and, you know, often know a lot of trivia about it. You know, they are really, really similar things.
That's actually quite true. I could be quite laddish.
I tell you what, though, I was actually out on my bike this morning, and it just stressed me. I mean, you know the weird things that go through your head when you're doing exercise. It distressed me that I could not remember who wrote the last episode of Blake 7, and it really got to me. I was about 3 miles, so I'm like, just really, I can't remember. This is really annoying. And no, it's not Termination. It's not Termination. I had to come home and look it up, and it was like, that's my geek credentials out of the window. I'm sorry.
And who was it?
Or maybe I'm just old.
Dave, who was it?
I can't remember. I had to look it up. I've forgotten already. Sorry. Oh, God. He wrote for Doctor Who as well, and I can't think what his name is. And he's like, this is it. I'm getting old, though. I think that means I'm not a geek. I'm just, like, ancient.
A lot of stuff to remember.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And that's what IMDb is for.
Yeah, hang on.
As long as you still recite the companions in the correct order.
No, can't do that. Can't do that because I'm such a New Who guy. I can't go back all the way, unfortunately. So
you could go back as far as Rose, but you couldn't go back as far as Susan.
I reckon you. Yeah, I think that's the case. Yeah, for me.
Less
I think. I think that.
I think one of the great things about working at SFX as it is now is that there's always somebody that knows the best. You can go to Nick for a specific thing, or you can go to Ian for a specific thing, and they just.
Right.
The most incredible thing, and it's just brilliant. It's great that you can, you know, there's always somebody that knows, that really knows their stuff about one thing or the other. And, and yeah, it's, I've never really experienced that working on magazines before. So that is really, really good, I'd say, on a personal level. Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, it's that sort of back catalogue of greatness that's been built up.
Well, I think that's a nice thing as well. In the office, you often learn stuff, you know, that you wouldn't learn just reading about it. You know, just stuff will come up in chat. God, that is really interesting. And one of your colleagues will actually be able to tell you something about something you're really interested in that you would never have found anywhere else. And that's actually quite a privilege.
I've got one final question for you guys. And it's that finish your sentence. So if I weren't a magazine editor, I would be...
unemployed, most likely.
if I wasn't
a tree surgeon.
So I'm actually not a magazine editor anymore. So that's an interesting thing. So I found a whole afterlife, a career working for working in kind of B2B conferences for the video game industry. But what that does, maybe the kind of that sort of wish list thing is, if I wasn't working in the media, then maybe I'd be a video game designer. I think games. That's a kind of fandom and a geekdom that I had that wasn't actually that prevalent on SFX when I was there. I don't know, there weren't that many game players, but I've always been a gamer. So maybe if I wasn't doing this, I'd create video games. Maybe that's what I do. What about you, Rich? Mm-hmm.
A completely different person. I think it's just been my life for as long as I can remember, sort of working on magazines, so and writing stuff and editing. So yeah, I don't know who or what I would be without it.
Yeah, I'd say the same. I think it's one of those things where it's sort of the line blurs between your job and your personal life, because it's something that you just love so much. It's mm-hmm. it's a strange thing, and I think that if anyone could ever have that experience, then you absolutely should. Mm-hmm. You know, work towards doing something that you love is fantastic. I mean, that should be everyone's goal.
If that's whetted your appetite for more SFX, don't forget there's a new issue out every month, and it's available in all good newsagents. You can also subscribe or buy individual issues at magazinesdirect.com. You can also follow the mag on Facebook and Twitter at SFX Magazine, or read loads of great SFX content at gamesradar.com. As for Robbie the Robot's Waiting, we have new episodes out every fortnight. You can listen to our back catalogue on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll find Unashamed Geekery on the latest news and releases, plus special guests and retro chat on classics such as Buffy, The X-Files, Battlestar Galactica, Dune, and more. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Robbie Sci-Fi. Thanks for listening.
By the way, it was Chris Boucher.
Oh, okay.
Thank goodness we know that.
I know. we can all go to sleep. And
said that. There's been somebody listening to this going, Chris Boucher!